Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The massive collection of telephone data by the clandestine U.S. National Security Agency to thwart terrorist attacks has been halted in a Washington legislative standoff, but a reform version of the surveillance could be renewed in the coming days. The spies agency lost the legal authority to collect telephone records Sunday at midnight when the U.S. Senate failed to agree on an extension of several provisions it put in place following the September 11, 2001 terror attacks. Earlier Sunday, Central Intelligence Director John Brennan urged the Senate to pass the new legislation, warning that terrorists were looking to take advantage of any gap in the spying effort. A U.S. citizen held in Yemen has been released following a report by a leading newspaper that four Americans were in Houthi custody in the Yemeni capital. There is no indication of who held the man who then traveled to Oman after he was freed. Earlier Monday, the first video of a French woman kidnapped in Yemen months ago surfaced on social media, showing the distraught 30-year-old pleading with the presidents of France and Yemen for rescue.
Mr. Hollande and Mr. Hadi, my name is Isabel. I've been kidnapped 10 weeks ago in Yemen, in Sana'a. Please bring me to France fast because I'm really, really tired.
French diplomatic officials confirmed the footage of Isabella Prime, posted 2 months after she and a translator were snatched by uniformed men from a car in the capital, Sana'a. Prime worked as a consultant for a firm tied to the World Bank at the time. The translator was later released. The identities of Prime's captors remain unknown at this time. This is VOA News. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in favor of an American woman who was denied a job because she wears a headscarf. Samantha Eloff, a Muslim who covers her hair for religious reasons, began her legal battle in 2008 when an Abercrombie and Fitch store in Oklahoma rejected the then 17-year-old after an in-person interview. The assistant manager who interviewed her believed she was qualified to be hired, but a superior manager said the headscarf would violate the store's dress code. Eloff did not ask for a religious accommodation to that policy, but the Supreme Court ruled businesses are obligated to figure out whether one is needed. A U.S. senior official says Qatar has agreed to temporarily extend travel and monitoring restrictions on five senior Taliban leaders released last year from the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in exchange for a captured American soldier. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
The U.S. official said the restrictions on the five Taliban leaders will remain in effect until a diplomatic solution to their fate can be found. The year-long restrictions on the five, imposed in May 2014, were set to expire Monday. Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, the director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan, says the five are Afghan citizens. He has personally been in touch with Qatari officials over what is in the best interest of U.S. national security.
I want to make sure that they're not going to be allowed to return to the fight. And I think this is part of a rehabilitation process as well as a monitoring and observing process.
Qatar last year agreed to take the five as part of an agreement to free U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who was held by the Taliban in Afghanistan for 5 years since walking away from his army post. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry returns home Monday after breaking his leg in a bicycle accident. Kerry was hospitalized in the Swiss city of Geneva after the crash Sunday in France, about 40 kilometers from the Swiss border. Kerry, who fractured his femur, will receive further treatment in Boston. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter has pledged $18 million to help Vietnam buy American-made Coast Guard patrol boats to improve its maritime defense capabilities. Carter is in the communist state to boost military ties. As part of that effort, he and his Vietnamese counterpart signed a vision statement Monday to guide the expansion of bilateral cooperation. That includes the U.S. helping Vietnam to prepare for taking part in U.N. peacekeeping operations. And bad weather is grounding a solar-powered Swiss airplane in the most difficult leg of its journey around the globe, powered only by the sun. The Solar Impulse 2 will land Monday in Japan, delaying a landmark attempt by the solar plane to cross the Pacific Ocean. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Central African Republic's interim president is pleading with the international community to help develop the war-ravaged country. She says although there are high prospects for peace to return, the humanitarian situation in CAR remains a major problem.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzika with the latest from the CAR. We'll have full details coming up. Also, police report that more than 29 Nigerians died in a Saturday night rocket assault on the northeastern city of Maiduguri. Burundi's president will consider delaying June 26 national elections for at least 45 days. And a research institute is working to give African immigrants a stronger voice in Washington, D.C. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, police report that more than 29 Nigerians died in a Saturday night rocket assault on the northeastern city of Maiduguri. At least 16 of them were killed when a suicide bomber struck a mosque in the Gamboru market. Dozens more were wounded. The city of 2 million people is the capital of Borno State, one of three states that have been the scene of 6 years of violence by Boko Haram insurgents. Maiduguri is also the birthplace of the Islamic sect that turned to violence when its leader was killed 6 years ago. Nigerian military were able to repel the insurgents in Maiduguri. And in other Nigerian news, Reuters reports that a fuel tanker has crashed in a busy bus station in Onitsha, southeastern Nigeria. The Red Cross says up to 70 people were killed and dozens wounded. Many of the dead were burned alive and over a dozen nearby vehicles incinerated. Corpses are being transferred to a local teaching hospital for DNA testing, identification, and proper burial. A police spokesman told Reuters the tanker was speeding when it veered out of control. Central African Republic's interim president is pleading with the international community to help develop the country. She says although there are high prospects for peace to return, the humanitarian situation in CAR remains a major problem. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
CAR's interim president, Catherine Samba Panza, says after a May summit bringing together 700 representatives from political parties and civil society groups, she believes it is imperative to give an accounting to the international community and CAR's diaspora. The gathering was intended to clear the way for national elections expected in August to end CAR's 2-year political crisis. However, Mrs. Samba Panza says humanitarian crises continue to batter her country and CAR remains far from stable despite the presence of 8,500 UN peacekeepers in Bangui.
Je suis donc allé mobiliser la communauté internationale sur la nécessité de continuer à nous soutenir pour que nous
She says the most important thing is for the international community to continue providing humanitarian and financial resources. She says without such help, it will be difficult for elections to be organized. Mrs. Samba Panza has been serving as interim president since January 2014. She says all Central Africans she met in Cameroon and other countries she visited are anxiously waiting for elections so their country can return to democratic law and put the period of sectarian killings behind them.
J'ai été très honorée par l'accueil qui m'a été réservé au Cameroun, précisément par la commune de Douala.
She says the massive turnout of CAR refugees to receive her in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala, is a strong indication that everyone wants peace to return to CAR so they can go back and contribute to the development of their country. Last month, the UN called on the international community to send aid to the country's population. But so far, international donors have contributed just $83 million in aid out of the estimated $604 million required. The UN reports that 460,000 people have fled CAR to neighboring countries, and an estimated 440,000 people, mostly women and children, are internally displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Facing weeks of violent protests at home and an appeal from African leaders on Sunday, the president of Burundi will consider delaying June 26 national elections for at least 45 days. The head of the African Union met yesterday in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, with heads of state from Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and South Africa, and ministers from Rwanda and Burundi to request the delay. Mr. Nkurunziza's spokesman said the president was too busy with preparations for a June election to attend the meeting. The spokesman said any delay determined by Burundi's election commission should not violate a constitutional guarantee that a new president is sworn into office by August 26th. Mr. Nkurunziza's April decision to run for a third term sparked a constitutional debate and weeks of protest in the capital, Bujumbura. The capital was quiet this morning, but opposition leaders have called for renewed protests. They say they are disappointed the East African Summit did not take a stand on the constitutional issue of a third term for the president. Rights groups say at least 20 people have been killed by police since protests began. There are fears violence could lead to renewed ethnic bloodletting between the Hutu and Tutsi communities. More than 90,000 Burundians have fled the country, according to the UN's refugee agency, UNHCR. Protests took place yesterday in some suburbs of the city. One person was injured late on Saturday when a grenade exploded in the city center. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 13 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Police report that more than 29 Nigerians died in a Saturday night rocket assault on the northeastern city of Maiduguri. Central African Republic's interim president is pleading with the international community to help develop the country. And Burundi's president is considering delaying the June 26 national elections for at least 45 days. And for more news and information, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. Well, pay back the money has become a rallying cry in South Africa for politicians and citizens who want President Jacob Zuma to repay back some $20 million in public money spent on upgrades to his private homestead. But this week, the nation's police minister cleared Mr. Zuma of any responsibility, saying the upgrades, which included a swimming pool and a cattle enclosure, were necessary for presidential security. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's police minister has declared that President Jacob Zuma does not have to pay back any of the $20 million in government money that was used for improvements on his private homestead. He says the features that have grabbed headlines, a swimming pool, a cattle corral, an amphitheater, and a visitor center, are necessary security upgrades. The scandal has followed Mr. Zuma for years, and the nation's public protector wrote a 2014 report condemning the use of government funds and recommending that the president pay back a reasonable portion of the money. That report has prompted Mr. Zuma's political opponents to disrupt recent parliamentary sessions with insistent calls that he pay back the money. He has refused and says he did nothing wrong and that he did not ask for the upgrades. Police Minister Nathi Nhleko this week issued his long-awaited report, in which he addressed the four most contentious items in the rural homestead.
Evidence points to the questionable features, namely the animal enclosure, in other words, the cattle crawl, and or goat crawl with culvert and chicken run, the fire pool referred to as the swimming pool, the soil retention wall referred to as the amphitheater, and visitor center as being security features, which are in accordance with the physical security requirements and or interests. Accordingly, the state president is therefore not liable to pay for any of these security features.
The swimming pool, renamed a fire pool for its firefighting purposes, was described as the most important security asset because local fire services are slow and the area is dry and prone to catching fire. The cattle corral, he said, keeps livestock away from the security perimeter, and the chicken run prevents wayward chickens from tripping motion detector beams. The amphitheater, Klecko concluded, is an emergency assembly point, and the visitor center is an important security control point for guests and for visiting dignitaries. He added that the widespread reporting of the affair was an affront to the president's security, and that it might warrant more security upgrades.
His family has concomitantly suffered the violation and breach of their security and safety. It is an unprecedented phenomenon the world over that a president's security and privacy is violated to the degree that we have witnessed in South Africa.
One South African journalist at the Cape Town briefing asked a question that is on the minds of many South Africans, namely, do you really think we are that stupid? The journalist was accused of being disrespectful. The nation's main opposition party condemned the report and says it is investigating how to mount a legal challenge. Here's Democratic Alliance spokesman Mabine Siabe.
The Democratic Alliance is appalled by what we've dubbed a whitewash report, which has absolved the president of any accountability for the millions of dollars that have been spent on one man's private residence when there are five other presidential residents for the president to use.
Siabe says the saga is far from over and that Mr. Zuma has not heard the last of the pay back the money refrain. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Vessels of the European Union's Triton fleet have rescued more than 5,000 migrants from boats in distress on the Mediterranean in the last 3 days. Yesterday, an Italian vessel recovered 454 passengers and 17 corpses off the coast of Sicily. Frontex Executive Director Fabrice Legari says ships from EU's Triton force encountered 25 boats of migrants sailing from Libya to Europe over the weekend. Legari said the weekend action represents the most intense migrant traffic of the year. Calm sailing weather has triggered increased migration. Rescue ships from Italy, Malta, Belgium, Iceland, and Finland executed the rescues. Vessels from Germany, Ireland, and Denmark are also participating in the Triton project. More than 40,000 migrants have been picked up in Mediterranean waters this year. The EU seeks the endorsement of the UN Security Council to launch an enforcement operation against smugglers on the Libyan coast. A larger EU proposal to ask member countries to accept asylum quotas is meeting opposition from many European leaders. The Washington, D.C. Mayor's Office on African Affairs and the George Mason University's Institute for Immigration Research announced a collaboration that will focus on the African immigrant population in Washington. The U.S. Capitol is the second most popular destination in the U.S. for about 161,000 African immigrants. The survey research will determine age, employment, education, and the cultural diversity among African-born constituents from various countries on the continent. Sophia Khalid is the executive director of the Institute for Immigration Research at George Mason University. She spoke with me about the motivation behind the survey.
Washington, D.C. is the fifth largest immigrant destination in the U.S. and the second destination of choice for about 161,000 African immigrants. Yet, there's somewhat limited research available focusing specifically on the African community. For example, existing data collected primarily by the U.S. Census does not distinguish between Black, African American, and other. So it's challenging to extract data relevant specifically to the African population. And this limitation was the motivation behind conducting the survey.
When will the survey begin and how will it be conducted?
The survey will begin in the fall of 2015 and will conclude by the end of the year. We will design and send survey questionnaires to various African immigrant communities, businesses, professionals in the district through the assistance of Mr. Mamadou Samba, who is the director of the D.C. Mayor's Office on African Affairs. The survey will include questions related to employment, education, community involvement, housing, and so forth.
Now, these results, how will they be used to help African immigrants?
Well, the survey results will uncover evidence of economic and social contribution of the D.C. African immigrants, and it will create a new confidential and in-depth data source describing the African community. Also, the results will facilitate the work of service providers and government agencies by connecting the African community to resources available. I would also like to add that the survey results will be shared with participants, community organizations, advocacy groups, and will be available via the internet to all residents in the DC metro area.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges that African immigrants face in Washington, DC?
The challenges that exist for African immigrants are similar to those experienced by other immigrant groups as they come and integrate into a new country and culture. These include lack of access to health, education, employment, and business opportunities. Also, there is the issue of underemployment. There are highly educated Africans not being able to find work that compensates them fairly for their skills.
And then what can Washington offer African immigrants?
I think Washington, D.C. is an immigrant-friendly city. D.C. is home to a large number of African-born immigrants representing a multitude of languages, culture, and socioeconomic background. In fact, Washington, D.C. has the only office on African affairs established at the municipal level in the U.S. This means that there is a commitment to welcome Africans, support their development, and recognize their role as active participants in the city's economic and social life.
Also, Sophia, can you tell us a little bit about the Institute for Immigration Research and really just what the whole objective of the Institute is?
Absolutely. The Institute for Immigration Research is a joint venture between George Mason University and the Immigrant Learning Center of Massachusetts. Research conducted by the Institute examines the economic impact of all immigrant groups with a focus on the economic contributions of immigrant entrepreneurs with high level of education or skills.
Sophia Khalid is the executive director of the Institute for Immigration Research at George Mason University. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Cameroon has begun a mass vaccination program to combat a measles epidemic. Medics say the outbreak is getting worse because parents are failing to have their children vaccinated against the preventable disease. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
Dr. Marie Kobela, permanent secretary of Cameroon's national vaccination program, says the measles outbreak was declared in Yaoundé after seven health districts clinically diagnosed at least three consecutive cases of measles in the month of May. She says the epidemic started because parents either refuse or forget to have their children vaccinated when they are 9 months old, as recommended by the World Health Organization, WHO. She says when a child is detected with the disease, all children around who are not vaccinated are exposed because measles is a very contagious disease. Kobela says surveillance teams have been deployed to areas of reported outbreaks. She says people should cooperate with them and report all suspected cases to the nearest hospitals.
C'est un enfant qui va faire de la fièvre, qui aura une éruption cutanée.
She says people should immediately rush children to hospitals if they have fever, persistent wet noses, red eyes, and little wounds around their mouths, because those are high indications they suffer from measles. She says women should breastfeed their children regularly during such periods and make sure they have vitamin A supplements. Ngambi Martin, leader of one of the vaccination teams in Yaoundé, says they have been deployed to encourage people to be vaccinated if they cannot show that they were vaccinated as children or have never had measles or are infants 6 to 11 months of age.
Dans l'aide de santé de Nkwa Bank, il y a cette équipe de vaccination composée d'un mobilisateur.
He says he leads 7 vaccination teams in his area, and each team has a vaccination agent and someone who mobilizes people and explains the importance of vaccination so that they can totally adhere to the program. The last time Cameroon reported measles outbreaks was from February 2010 to July 2011, when 37 out of the 179 health districts in the country were affected. Measles is a disease caused by virus that is spread through the air by breathing, coughing, or sneezing. The measles virus is highly contagious and can remain in the air, ready to infect for up to 2 hours. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The World Food Programme said today that ongoing violence around Yemen's southern port city of Aden forced a ship carrying badly needed food aid to change course and instead dock in Hodeidah on the country's west coast. The UN agency was staging aid donations in nearby Djibouti. They moved the food and medical supplies to Yemen to reach the millions of civilians affected by months of clashes between Houthi rebels and pro-government forces. A WFP statement said the diverted ship was carrying enough food to feed 60,000 people for a month. They say aid workers will now have to travel by road to get supplies to people near Aden who are in desperate need of food. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, there's need to have an intelligent computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Police report that more than 29 Nigerians died in a Saturday night rocket assault on the northeastern city of Maiduguri. Central African Republic's interim president is pleading with the international community to help develop the country. And Burundi's president is considering delaying the June 26 national elections for at least 45 days. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand we'll hear this evening from a top Ghanaian sports official.
Kim, Ghana's new youth and sports minister, Dr. Mustafa Ahmed, has climbed between the ropes with Nnamdi Moeta at the Wild Card Boxing Club in Los Angeles, California. Our VOA boxing fans will remember Wild Card is the gym owned and operated by Hall of Fame trainer Freddie Roach. Nnamdi asked the sports minister, how do you plan to revive boxing in Ghana?
First and foremost, to unify the community, the entire boxing community in the country, bring them all under one federation, that's the Ghana Boxing Federation. And then I think with that, we can move together and make sure that we bring progress to the sport of boxing in Ghana.
What are the challenges that you currently face in implementing some of these plans?
Well, obviously, for every developing country like Ghana, funding is the key challenge, and especially in the face of numerous competing needs that are coming up, health, education, and so on and so forth. So sports gets the short end of the stick, and I believe that if we unite, if we are able to unite the entire community, we should be able to attract the attention of the government as well as the private sector to come to the aid of boxing. In so doing, we'll be able to also address the issues of infrastructure, because we do not have adequate boxing gyms, even the equipment that is needed, the facilities for bringing people together, and then so on and so forth. So we need to do that to ensure that we attract a lot of investment from the private sector and let it be seen as a place where people can invest their money in, and then it will yield dividends to them as well as to the youth who will be taken up to boxing as a sport.
With a country such as Ghana facing issues like power crisis, economy, labor agitations, what is the significance of a boxing gym? Why the focus on the boxing?
Well, I believe in the adage that man must not live by bread and water alone. And therefore, in the face of all these other crises that you've mentioned, we still need to explore the opportunities that are available in sports, especially in the areas where Ghana has had made name, where we have a comparative advantage, where we have established ourselves as good on the continent. If you take football, you take athletics, you take boxing, we have distinguished ourselves in those areas. And therefore, it stands to reason that if we want to focus on these sports, it will yield a lot more dividend, especially the benefits that it has or it holds for the youth, particularly from deprived communities, people who perhaps otherwise wouldn't have made it through the regular education channels, who can also take advantage of the opportunities in these areas of sports and make it.
What brings you to Hollywood?
Hollywood has made fame not only in filmmaking,
but also in providing adequate facilities for people who have made name in boxing. So I'm here in particular to look at some of the boxing gyms that have been able to attract the great boxing talents in the world, and where they have trained, used the facilities there to train and attained greater heights, so that we can also replicate something like that in Ghana.
Honorable Minister, you're here with us at the famous Wildcard Boxing Gym, where one of the best trainers train fighters, and Manny Pacquiao trained for his mega fight. Why did you come to Wildcard?
I think that in Ghana, we follow what we think is good. And therefore, coming to Wildcard, as you've mentioned, this is the place where world champions have trained. And it's, for me, it is better to come here, see what it is that has made them champions, and try and replicate same back at home, and give opportunities to our boxers to also attain greater heights in boxing. Wildcard has made name and is famous. It's like one of the top places for training boxers in the world, not only in America, but it's a world-class training facility. And therefore, my decision to go there, and then I have to express gratitude to Freddie Roach for receiving me and allowing me to tour the facility and seeing what it takes to produce great world boxing champions. And perhaps with his support, encouragement that I got from him, we should be able to replicate something like that in Ghana, to also offer opportunities for Ghanaian boxers to also attain greater heights.
In Africa, the focus has always been soccer, you know, from the president down to the minister, you know, to everybody, soccer. Do you see a chance where a country like Ghana can produce great champions like they did in the past?
Indeed, that is one of the key visions of the president, the current president of Ghana, President John Dramani Mahama. His vision is to offer opportunities, invest in the other sporting disciplines, continue to invest in football, but let us also pay attention to the other disciplines. Because in the past, we've been able to produce great champions in athletics, in boxing. Ghana in the past has produced number of champions in boxing: Floyd Robertson, DK Poison, Azuma Nelson, Ike Corte, King Kong Agbeko, Fred Lawson, Nana Yao, and then also Baba Sumaila, our own Baba Sumaila, who has made a name for himself and is one of the few, or the perhaps the only African boxing trainer at the Wildcard Gym here in LA. And I think that this is a plus for Ghana. We are hoping that if we are able to do something similar in Ghana, we should be able to attract all these personalities to support and promote the sport of boxing in Ghana.
Honorable Minister, you've just finished visiting the Wildcard Gym right here in Hollywood. What are the chances of we having something like this on the ground in Accra, Ghana?
Well, we needed this yesterday in Ghana, but with the vision and then what I've seen here at Wildcard, I'm more inspired to now push even stronger ahead to ensure that within the next 1 year, we have something going in Ghana.
That's Dr. Mustafa Ahmed, Ghana's youth and sports minister, and he was talking with Namdi Hollywood Moweta at the Wildcard Boxing Club in Los Angeles, California. Ghana's sports minister mentioned former world bantamweight champion Joseph King Kong Agbeko in his chat with Namdi. King Kong was back in the ring for the first time in almost 18 months over the weekend in El Paso, Texas. He stopped Filipino fighter Juanito Rubilar by fourth-round technical knockout. The bout was stopped after Rubilar suffered a cut over his left eye. Agbeko says he'll use the comeback win to propel him towards another world title shot. King Kong improved his record to 30 wins and 5 losses with 23 knockouts. Rubilar has now lost 10 of his past 11 fights, and his record stands at 49 victories, 23 defeats, and 7 draws. Now let's go to New Zealand for an update on the FIFA Under-20 World Cup football tournament. The Flying Eagles of Nigeria lost to Brazil Monday 4-2 in New Plymouth. Gabriel Jesus gave the Brazilian boys an early lead with a goal in the 4th minute. Isaac Success also found success early in the match, getting the equalizer for Nigeria 6 minutes later. Musa Yayaya put the Nigerian boys in front with a goal in the 28th minute before the Brazilians equalized in the 34th minute on a goal by Judivan. Gabriel Bochilha gave Brazil a 3-2 lead in the 59th minute before Judivan scored his second goal of the game in the 82nd minute. Final score from New Plymouth, New Zealand, Brazil 4, Nigeria 2. In Monday's other results, Hungary beat North Korea 5-1. Germany whacked Fiji 8-1 in the most lopsided match of the tourney so far. And Honduras edged Uzbekistan 4-3. For a look at the African results from the weekend in New Zealand, here's Marco Uma.
Africans had mixed results at the men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand on Sunday. Goals scored late in the second half by striker Adama Traore and attacking midfielder Barclay Diudone lifted Mali to a 2-0 triumph over Mexico in Dundee. Tournament debutants Senegal received their baptism of fire when they went down 3-0 to Portugal in Hamilton. Early on Saturday, Ghana and Austria drew 1-1. Meanwhile, here in South Africa, winger Dion Hot scored twice as Namibia beat Mozambique 2-0 in the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup final at the Moruleng Stadium in Northwest Province on Saturday. Earlier on, Madagascar edged Botswana 2-1 in the bronze medal playoff. Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. Turning to tennis, defending women's champion Maria Sharapova of Russia was knocked out of the French Open on Monday. Sharapova fell in straight sets 7-6 and 6-4. To 13th-seeded Czech player Lucy Safarova. Top-seeded Serena Williams advanced to the quarterfinals with a victory over American countrywoman Sloane Stephens. Serena dropped the first set 6-1, but then took the next two 7-5 and 6-3. In men's action, Swiss star Roger Federer advanced to the quarterfinals with a four-set victory over Frenchman Gael Monfils. And third-seeded Scotsman Andy Murray also moved into the final eight with a four-set victory over a Frenchman, Jeremy Chardy. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, communication professionals from across Africa are working to project a positive image of the continent, and a new smartphone device can diagnose cancer cells in a blood sample. First, here's Stella Nanteza of Uganda with Tawale Kimulema.
Atunyweza na atuimusa.
Stella Nantaza with Tawale Kimulema. While communication professionals from across Africa want to project a positive image of the continent, experts who recently gathered at a meeting of the Africa Public Relations Association say the Western world focuses too much on negative issues in Africa. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
Bernard Solo, lecturer at the University of Calabar in Nigeria, says Africa's image has been painted by Western media outlets in particular as that of a continent riddled with strange diseases, poor, heavily indebted, conflict-prone and ablaze in war.
We've been having unfortunate stories on Africans drowning in the Mediterranean. But what we don't say, the success stories of Africans flying back from Europe with the PhDs and MBAs and bachelor's degrees to come back to Africa and start companies and contribute positively to the development of GDPs of our respective economies. Let's pick on the few positive aspects on Africa and build on that, then people will start having a different perspective of what's happening in Africa.
Charles Nklonzo from Daystar University in Kenya says the dark image of Africa is a result of many of its leaders' failures to assure governance and accountability and to practice democracy. He says many African leaders care more about maintaining power than attending to pressing needs of the people they are supposed to serve.
When you look at what is happening in Africa, we have Boko Haram. In East Africa, we have Al-Shabaab, Mediterranean issues around there. And in South, we have the xenophobic issues. These are issues that leaders must not sit back and assume that somehow they'll fade away tomorrow. For example, in Kenya, where Al-Shabaab is a big issue, how does my government work to ensure that Kenya is portrayed not just like everywhere in Kenya is hit by Al-Shabaab? And the same happens in Nigeria, the same happens in Mediterranean and even South Africa.
Lionel Tusse, a Cameroonian-born public relations expert, says Africa is given a horrible image because African states and organizations pay particular attention to negative issues and neglect to communicate positive developments on the continent. He says the Africa Public Relations Association APRA meeting in Yaoundé has decided to work with governments to build a positive image of the continent. He says after more than 50 years of independence for most African states, it is high time for its people to communicate positively and sell the image of their continent. He says there is need for all countries, all civil society organizations, and all African enterprises to manage their reputations by setting up image-building structures managed by Africans for an efficient practice of public relations. Bogwa Jirogi, an APRA official in Kenya, says the experts are unanimous in believing that the reality of much of Africa is quite different from the perceptions outsiders have, and have resolved to work with the African Union to tell more positive stories about the continent.
What we want to do is to come up together telling our own story. Go to West Africa, there are so many projects that are being initiated. Our tourism industry is booming. We have the most ambitious infrastructure in Kenya today. If you look at our education system, it's superb. We are churning out so many graduates, and these are the stories that we want to talk about, stories of hope, stories of success, not the stories of despair like has been exemplified and by the foreign media.
The International Monetary Fund predicts Africa will have the largest economic growth in the world over the next decade, and domestic industries and foreign investors are already taking advantage of this growth by investing in the continent. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
A new smartphone device can diagnose cancer cells in a blood sample. The technology is portable, so it can be used in remote areas where more sophisticated equipment for cancer detection is in short supply. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Diagnosing cancer usually involves the expertise of trained specialists called cytologists, high-powered microscopes, and other equipment. Cytologists look for cancer cells in a sample of blood or tissue obtained through a biopsy. Such technology and skilled personnel are not often available in rural settings, especially in Africa or Asia. But researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston have streamlined the process with a smartphone device that anyone can be trained to use. In a study involving 25 cell samples from women suspected of having cervical cancer, the cell phone's tiny camera came up with a preliminary diagnosis within 45 minutes. And it did so with near 100% accuracy, distinguishing high-risk cells from low-risk and non-cancerous cells. Cesar Castro is a medical oncologist at Mass General and lead author of the study. Castro says the phone records shadowy holographic type images that are sent to and deciphered remotely by a computer.
The images get sent to a remote server, so through the wireless system, and a computer does the graphically intense processing that then recreates pretty much a high resolution image of the cells and then potentially the presence or of beads. And so that if we see cells with beads decorated on them, then there's a suspicion that there's something not normal present in that sample.
Microscopic beads are added to the blood sample collected in a cube-shaped module attached tightly to the phone. The microbeads contain targeted antibodies or proteins that seek out cancerous cells. If they find any, the beads adhere to proteins on the outside of the cancerous cells. The small cube attached to the smartphone is called D3, the Digital Diffraction and Diagnosis System. It uses a battery-powered LED for illumination and is able to capture data from more than 100,000 cells in a sample. The test, according to Castro, can be performed by just about anyone.
This could be done, whether it be in your local primary care office, whether it could be done even potentially at home, if we were to use other samples beyond biopsy, such as blood, for example, with a pink prick, not unlike the amount of blood that a diabetic would secure in order to read how much how high their sugars are. Or down the line, we're working another alternative specimen, such as urine or saliva.
Castro says the test is very inexpensive, with a total cost of less than $2 for the module, battery, and microbeads. An article describing the D3 cancer detecting system is published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is not a coincidence that countries are more stable and prosperous when women enjoy rights that are comparable to those of men, and when women participate in governance and in the formal economy. These countries are also less vulnerable to the impacts of violent extremism. This is a phenomenon we see across the globe, wrote U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues Catherine Russell in a recent blog post. Economies are stronger when women are in the labor force and afforded the same opportunities as men. Outcomes from peace negotiations are better when women have seats at the table. Countries are more stable when women are valued and given opportunities to reach their full potential. In the global effort to prevent and counter violent extremism, issues that most affect women are frequently dismissed, and too often women's rights become a bargaining chip. We know that women are key players in preventing violence. Over the years, we have seen that women's leadership and participation in their communities create stability and help build stronger communities that are less prone to conflict. Strong, empowered women are the foundation of strong, prosperous societies. That is why, under the administration of President Barack Obama, advancing the status and empowerment of women and girls around the world has been integrated into U.S. foreign policy. It is time for all of us to recognize that women's empowerment is crucial to the well-being of every society. And it is long past due to recognize that women's issues are issues that deeply affect every society as a whole. The resolution of such issues and women's participation in the process is crucial to every country's prospects for peace and economic stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee.